Chapter 42. Appearing this costly garment during the first year or two of marriage. His mother, he knew, kept hers in tissue paper in the hope that Janie might someday wear it, though poor Janie was reaching the age when pearl gray poplin and no bridesmaids would be thought more appropriate. It struck Archer that May, since their return from Europe, had seldom worn her bridal satin, and the surprise of seeing her in it made him compare her appearance with that of the young girl he had watched with such blissful anticipations 2 years earlier. Though May's outline was slightly heavier, as her goddess-like build had foretold, her athletic erectness of carriage, and the girlish transparency of her expression, remained unchanged. But for the slight languor that Archer had lately noticed in her, she would have been the exact image of the girl playing with a bouquet of lilies of the valley on her betrothal evening. The fact seemed an additional appeal to his pity. Such innocence was as moving as the trustful clasp of a child. Then he remembered the passionate generosity latent under that incurious calm. He recalled her glance of understanding when he had urged that their engagement should be announced at the Beaufort Ball. He heard the voice in which S.E. had said, in the Mission Garden, "Couldn't have my happiness made out of a wrong to someone else," and an uncontrollable longing seized him to tell her the truth, to throw himself on her generosity, and ask for the freedom he had once refused. Newland Archer was a quiet and self-controlled young man. Conformity to the discipline of a small society had become almost his second nature. It was deeply distasteful to him to do anything melodramatic and conspicuous, anything Mr. van der Luyden would have deprecated, and the club box condemned as bad form. But he had become suddenly unconscious of the club box, of Mr. van der Luyden, of all that had so long enclosed him in the warm shelter of habit. He walked along the semicircular passage at the back of the house, and opened the door of Mrs. van der Luyden's box, as if it had been a gate into the unknown. "Mama!" thrilled out the triumphant Marguerite, and the occupants of the box looked up in surprise at Archer's entrance. He had already broken one of the rules of his world, which forbade the entering of a box during a solo. Slipping between Mr. van der Luyden and Sillerton Jackson, he leaned over his wife. "I've got a beastly headache. Don't tell anyone, but come home, won't you?" he whispered. May gave him a glance of comprehension, and he saw her whisper to his mother, who nodded sympathetically. Then she murmured an excuse to Mrs. van der Luyden, and rose from her seat just as Marguerite fell into Faust's arms. Archer, while he helped her on with her opera cloak, noticed the exchange of a significant smile between the older ladies. As they drove away, May laid her hand shyly on his. "I'm so sorry you don't feel well. I'm afraid they've been overworking you again at the office." "No, it's not that. Do you mind if I open the window?" he returned confusedly, letting down the pane on his side. He sat staring out into the street, feeling his wife beside him as a silent, watchful interrogation, and keeping his eyes steadily fixed on the passing houses. At their door she caught her skirt in the step of the carriage, and fell against him. "Did you hurt yourself?" he asked, steadying her with his arm. "No. But my poor dress, see how I've torn it," she exclaimed. She bent to gather up a mud-stained breadth, and followed him up the steps into the hall. The servants had not expected them so early, and there was only a glimmer of gas on the upper landing. Archer mounted the stairs, turned up the light, and put a match to the brackets on each side of the library mantelpiece. The curtains were drawn, and the warm, friendly aspect of the room smote him like that of a familiar face met during an unavowable errand. He noticed that his wife was very pale, and asked if he should get her some brandy. "Oh, no," she exclaimed with a momentary flush, as she took off her cloak. "But hadn't you better go to bed at once?" she added, as he opened a silver box on the table and took out a cigarette. Archer threw down the cigarette and walked to his usual place by the fire. "No, my head is not as bad as that." He paused. And there's something I want to say, something important that I must tell you at once. S. He had dropped into an armchair, and raised her head as he spoke. S. Dear? She rejoined, so gently that he wondered at the lack of wonder with which she received this preamble. May, he began, standing a few feet from her chair, and looking over at her, as if the slight distance between them were an unbridgeable abyss. The sound of his voice echoed uncannily through the home like hush, and he repeated. Here's something I've got to tell you. About myself. She sat silent, without a movement or a tremor of her lashes. She was still extremely pale, but her face had a curious tranquility of expression that seemed drawn from some secret inner source. Archer checked the conventional phrases of self-accusal that were crowding to his lips. He was determined to put the case baldly, without vain recrimination or excuse. Madame Olenska, he said, but at the name his wife raised her hand, as if to silence him. As she did, so the gaslight struck on the gold of her wedding ring. Oh, why should we talk about Ellen tonight? She asked, with a slight pout of impatience. Because I ought to have spoken before. Her face remained calm. Is it really worthwhile, dear? I know I've been unfair to her at times, perhaps we all have. You've understood her, no doubt, better than we did. You've always been kind to her. But what does it matter, now it's all over. Archer looked at her blankly. Could it be possible that the sense of unreality in which he felt himself imprisoned had communicated itself to his wife? All over, what do you mean? He asked in an indistinct stammer. May still looked at him with transparent eyes. Hi, since she's going back to Europe so soon, since Granny approves and understands, and has arranged to make her independent of her husband, she broke off, and Archer, grasping the corner of the mantelpiece in one convulsed hand, and steadying himself against it, made a vain effort to extend the same control to his reeling thoughts. I supposed, he heard his wife's even voice go on, that you had been kept at the office this evening about the business arrangements. It was settled this morning, I believe. She lowered her eyes under his unseeing stare, and another fugitive flush passed over her face. He understood that his own eyes must be unbearable, and turning away, rested his elbows on the mantel-shelf, and covered his face. Something drummed and clanged furiously in his ears. He could not tell if it were the blood in his veins, or the tick of the clock on the mantel. May sat without moving or speaking, while the clock slowly measured out 5 minutes. A lump of coal fell forward in the grate, and hearing her rise to push it back, Archer at length turned and faced her. It's impossible, he exclaimed. Impossible, how do you know what you've just told me? I saw Ellen yesterday, I told you I'd seen her at Granny's. It wasn't then that she told you? No, I had a note from her this afternoon. Do you want to see it? He could not find his voice, and she went out of the room, and came back almost immediately. I thought you knew, she said simply. She laid a sheet of paper on the table, and Archer put out his hand, and took it up. The letter contained only a few lines. May dear, I have at last made Granny understand that my visit to her could be no more than a visit, and as he has been as kind and generous as ever. She sees now that, if I return to Europe I must live by myself, or rather with poor Aunt Medora, who is coming with me. I am hurrying back to Washington to pack up, and we sail next week. You must be very good to Granny, when I'm gone, as good as you've always been to me. Ellen, if any of my friends wish to urge me to change my mind, please tell them it would be utterly useless. Archer read the letter over 2 or 3 times, then he flung it down and burst out laughing. The sound of his laugh startled him. It recalled Janie's midnight fright, when S. He had caught him rocking with incomprehensible mirth over May's telegram announcing that the date of their marriage had been advanced. Why did she write this? He asked, checking his laugh with a supreme effort. May met the question with her unshaken candor. Suppose because we talked things over yesterday, what things? I told her I was afraid I hadn't been fair to her and always understood how hard it must have been for her here, alone among so many people who were relations and yet strangers, who felt the right to criticize, and yet didn't always know the circumstances. She paused. Knew you'd been the one friend she could always count on, and I wanted her to know that you and I were the same in all our feelings. She hesitated, as if waiting for him to speak, and then added slowly, he understood my wishing to tell her this. I think she understands everything. She went up to Archer, and taking one of his cold hands pressed it quickly against her cheek. My head aches too. Good night, dear, she said, and turned to the door, her torn and muddy wedding dash dress dragging after her across the room. XXXIII. It was, as Mrs. Archer smilingly said to Mrs. Welland, a great event for a young couple to give their first big dinner. The Newland Archers, since they had set up their household, had received a good deal of company in an informal way. Archer was fond of having three or four friends to dine, and May welcomed them with the beaming readiness, of which her mother had set her the example in conjugal affairs. Her husband questioned whether, if left to herself, she would ever have asked anyone to the house, but he had long given up trying to disengage her real self from the shape into which tradition and training had molded her. It was expected that well-off young couples in New York should do a good deal of informal entertaining, and a Welland married to an Archer was doubly pledged to the tradition. But a big dinner, with a hired chef and two borrowed footmen, with Roman punch, roses from Henderson's, and menus on gilt-edged cards, was a different affair, and not to be lightly undertaken. As Mrs. Archer remarked, the Roman punch made all the difference, not in itself, but by its manifold implications, since it signified either canvas backs or terrapin. Two soups, a hot and a cold sweet, full décolletage with short sleeves, and guests of a proportionate importance. It was always an interesting occasion when a young pair launched their first invitations in the third person, and their summons was seldom refused even by the seasoned and sought after. Still, it was admittedly a triumph that the Van der Luydens, at May's request, should have stayed over in order to be present at her farewell dinner for the Countess Olenska. The two mothers-in-law sat in May's drawing room on the afternoon of the great day, Mrs. Archer writing out the menus on Tiffany's thickest gilt-edged Bristol, while Mrs. Welland superintended the placing of the palms and standard lamps. Archer, arriving late from his office, found them still there. Mrs. Archer had turned her attention to the name cards for the table, and Mrs. Well, and was Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.